Cape Talk, Pippa's Planet.
Well, put a line through your diary for the next seven Sunday afternoons, because the second series of Blue Planet premieres this weekend on both BBC Earth and BBC Brit. And if you were lucky enough to watch the original series in 2001, you will know it featured some absolutely staggering visuals of life beneath the waves. Really got us to look at oceans from a completely different perspective and a quite breathtaking perspective. And here we are 17 years later. Science and technology have evolved to the point that we can go deeper and look further and closer than ever before. And here we have the second season of seven episodes airing, once again narrated by Sir David Attenborough, a beautiful original score by composer Hans Zimmer to go with it. If you've watched the trailer, you'll know how awe-inspiring the combination of the music and the photography is. If you haven't watched the trailer, please take a look at the Cape Talk Twitter feed, because we've tweeted it there for you to check out for yourself. And we were delighted and very proud to hear that a handful of Capetonians have actually contributed to the series, and we're so pleased to have them with us in studio today. Marine conservation photographers and videographers Lisa Labineau, Steve Benjamin and Roger Horrocks. Great to have all of you here. Thanks for popping in.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
It's taken 4 years to produce this series. They've gone on more than 120 expeditions, 39 different countries. Every continent has been filmed on. Every ocean has been looked at. I'm told more than 6,000 hours of underwater footage made the final cut. Steve, it must be, I mean, to say that it's a feather in your cap that amongst that final cut, there's some of your footage.
Absolutely. It was an incredible experience to work on a small section. You'll see in the first episode, we were tasked with filming super slow motion images of dolphins jumping out the water. And it was my responsibility to get the team out into the wild coast here on the South African coastline and help the cameramen actually get those images. And that involved boats and jet skis and a lot of time, a lot of observation. It's been amazing to see the response from everyone having watched it.
Okay, so you were the man who put it all together. Roger, you were the man actually holding the camera at that point.
Well, actually not on that sequence.
Not on that one, okay.
Not on that one, but I worked on four sequences. I contributed to four of the one-hour episodes.
Okay.
Two sequences in the Red Sea with bottlenose dolphins. Oh. And then a sequence that I'm really, really proud of, which I authored with, originally Steve and I kind of actually put the core basis of the idea together, but then it was really Craig Foster who brought the magic of the sequence, and it's really an octopus which has this ingenious way of escaping from pajama sharks, and that we spent about over a 2 year period, we spent over 70 days trying to film that 5 minute sequence, and it's one I'm really proud of.
That's extraordinary. Just say that again. Over 2 years you spent more than 70 days to film a sequence that was how long?
5 minutes.
I mean, the level of detail and the patience that goes into this kind of work is extraordinary, and it's something I want to explore a little bit in more depth with you. Lisa, just to bring you into the conversation here, a photographer based in Komiki, I believe, and you have the honor of knowing that your photograph is the cover image chosen for the DVD box set. How does that feel?
I have to say it's totally mind-blowing. It's absolutely everywhere. And when I first was contacted by the BBC to ask, who asked me to supply some images, because, of course, they've got all these incredible filmmakers and hours and hours and hours of video footage. And they said, we're actually a little bit short of stills. Can you help? So I managed to get some stills together and was expecting them to use them. I never expected them to be the iconic image. Mm. And they are, as Steve went to the premiere of the DSTV show, for this showing in South Africa, he showed me my pictures are on a popcorn box. Never mind the wall, anywhere else. My pictures are on a popcorn box. It's incredibly cool.
I mean, it's such a stunning photo. I mean, for those who haven't seen it yet, and this may come as a surprise to you because there hasn't been that much publicity to date about the fact that the series is coming. It's an image of a Cape fur seal. Tell us how and when that photo was taken.
So I'm really lucky that in Komiki, we aren't far away from Hout Bay, where there is a population of Cape fur seals. And one of the things that's amazing about them is they are so accessible. Anybody can go. You don't even have to get in the water. You can get on a boat and you can go and check them out. But we went on, my partner James and I, went on our little boat for 2 days. So unlike Roger's 2 years, we just went for 2 days and I jumped in the water. And for the first day, I think James got in the water with me. But then on day two, he was just like, it's too cold. So you can go and see these fur seals who are like puppies under the water, and such incredible fun. And this little spot in Dacre Island outside Hout Bay has got the most incredible little pocket of good visibility, which we do lack in the Cape waters a lot of the time. But you can go and these, even if you snorkel, you don't have to scuba dive, these seals just come up to you and want to swim and want to play. It's absolutely mind-blowing.
I'm glad you mentioned that they come to you and want to play, because one of the questions I wanted to pose to all three of you is about your interaction with your subjects. I mean, you're going in as with very marine-focused, conservation-focused, wanting to film them and document them for a series. Yet, how much interaction do you actually have with your subjects? Steve, is it something you actually try to shy away from, or if it comes, it happens naturally?
Well, you always want to be on the animal's terms and let them interact with you with room to behave naturally and never disturb them in any way. So, like Lisa mentioned, with the seals at Dacre Island, it's a place I spend a lot of time. And the seals are particularly interesting because they're curious, but they're playing with each other and kelp and just exploring their environment. So, you want to not impact them in any way, not have any detrimental effects to them, and let them have the space to do their natural behaviors. And that was the same with the dolphins for the sequence. You're really just spending the time waiting for them to act naturally around you. And then if you're lucky, get some good images of it.
I know you, I mean, someone's just messaged us, Steve, to say Steve Benjamin is incredible. Well done. Thanks for having him on the show. He actually takes people on seal snorkeling tours. But I'm very glad to hear that description. I'm thinking back to the first time I ever went on a dolphin tour. And as we got into the water, it was an incredible experience. But I did have a moment of feeling like we were intruding. And there was a sense of the animals getting a fright that we were there. And sort of they all corralled around the little baby that was with them and swam away from us. And I watched a couple of people really sort of chase after them. And it felt all wrong to me. If you're doing tours, I mean, I would imagine that you have to educate the people you're taking on a tour about how they interact with the animals.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're running trips most days in summer to Dacre Island to get visitors and anyone who wants to see Cape Fur seals. And we tell them not to interact and stay a meter away and let the seals have their own space. But ultimately, we're just swimming in an area that the seals are also happily swimming in. They take their time to see the snorkelers. They look very strange and don't swim very well compared to them.
Yeah.
And they have the space to act naturally. So in that particular instance at Dacre Island, it's definitely non-impactful and easy to let the animals have their space.
Mm-hmm.
Other ecotourism situations might be different, but I can't comment on those.
Okay, obviously you can only commit to being a responsible operator yourself. I mean, Roger, in your experience, we've heard Lisa already saying her partner said it's too cold, I'm not going back into that water. Spending 2 years of chasing 70 days worth of work for 5 minutes of footage, you must have to spend an extraordinary number of hours down there. Talk to us about the challenges. I mean, it's hard enough, anybody who's been to a national park and sat there trying to get that perfect photograph of a lion or a bird knows you've got to sit and wait for hours to get that perfect shot. Put yourself underwater, you're adding all the complications of tides and the temperature and the visibility. Talk to us about what it takes to get those shots.
Well, I think it's not that different to a topside environment in the sense that absolutely you do have to spend the time. In this context, we were actually quite constrained because we were working very, very shallow.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the visibility has been mentioned. That's why we had to do it over 2 years, because the vis is often so dirty. But again, it was a kind of area that we could work, but only really around the low tide. So we had about a 2 hour window. It depends. I've just been on a shoot now where we were spending up to 6 hours a day on rebreathers in sort of 3 hours at a time.
Sure.
Again, just waiting for the action to happen. There is that complication of time, but with rebreather technology, it's become literally like a topside shoot. You can spend a huge amount of time underwater.
I'm fascinated by this, the role of technology, because, I mean, all the marketing material for this new series is focusing on the fact that it's not just a reboot of Blue Planet. It's Blue Planet deeper, further, closer than we were able to look 17 years ago because of what technology and scientific development has done in those last 17 years. You've mentioned rebreathers. What else for each of you? What else would you say is the technological advance that has really contributed to your work and made a huge difference in the past 10, 15 years? Steve?
Jeez, the high ISO abilities, so to be able to see in very, very low light environments. There's a sequence in the film which they'll see where they bring phosphorescence to light into a world you'll never think. It looks like Avatar. It's incredible.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, the high speed shooting. You can shoot 1,000 frames a second at great resolutions. So those are two elements that I really found incredible.
But for me, you have to remember, it was 2001. The digital revolution has happened. So when I first was shooting underwater I started shooting underwater in 2004, the first camera that I ever used took film. There was no LCD screen on the back of it. It was a Nikonos. So you had to sit there and you had to, you're basically guessing what you're getting. But now that you've got the digital technology that comes on, you've got these massive cards that allow you to store the most incredible depth of detail in the footage. So also, never mind shooting in 4x3, 16 by now, 9, now we're in widescreen, and then it went to Ultra HD, and now some people are shooting in 8K, which means the amount of detail that you can zoom in and get and be able to see the amount of stuff that's happening in the ocean has just opened up a huge amount of wildlife filming, I think.
Roger?
Well, I think, you know, ironically, I think one of the biggest changes is what I might call the feedback loop, because you mentioned, you know, the digital screens. You know, back in the day of film, you couldn't see what you were shooting. You know, it was in the can, etc. Now, we can shoot something underwater. We can actually review it underwater, see what we're getting, make corrections. So there's that element. And then also, and I think this has perhaps been one of the biggest innovations in Blue Planet 2, is the kind of emotional storytelling. Mm-hmm. So, again, you know, we can shoot material, we can get back to land, use WhatsApp to take a video clip of some of the key material, send it back to the producer in Bristol, and get instant feedback from an editorial perspective about the story and the kind of shots we need. So, you know, again, I think, sure, we've had all these technological advances, but I think, you know, and you'll see this in Blue Planet 2, the development of the nature of the storytelling has changed. More cinematic, more emotional. And that's, yeah, I think that's been a huge sort of innovation, which has been enabled by technology. Yeah.
Trailer that you were talking about, I mean, when you pull that together, that, I don't even know how long it is. 2 minute trailer?
It's 2-3 minutes long.
Every single time I watch it, and it doesn't matter how many times I watch it, it gives me physical goosebumps.
Yes.
And I was talking to someone about it today and said, have you seen the trailer? And it, talking about it gave me goosebumps because, as you say, the team have just worked out how to take this incredible footage and tell the most amazing story with it.
It is. I mean, I exactly the same. I have goosebumps watching it every time. We've shared it, and I hope it's having the same impact on listeners. I just want to recap for those who might have entered the conversation a little bit later than others, that we're talking about the new season of Blue Planet, which will start airing this Sunday on BBC Earth and BBC Brit. With us in studio are three Cape Townians who are part of that production. Lisa Labigneau, Steve Benjamin and Roger Horrocks have all had some of their work included in this season, and it just looks extraordinary. I can't wait to see it. From the music, the emotional impact of the music, obviously the world-class narration that we expect from Sir David Attenborough helps a little bit as well, but it is extraordinary. A couple of listener questions coming through, and I just want to repeat the invitation that if you've got a question, you are very welcome to give us a call on 021-446-0567 or send an SMS to 31567. Keith asking on the SMS line, which sea creature was the most difficult to capture? Not just for this season, but in your years and years of underwater filming. Roger, what's been the most difficult?
Well, I think this octopus sequence that Craig and I shot for, it'll be in the Green Seas program, which I think is number 5. I think it's 5th in the series. You know, we pitched the idea, we got the green light, and I'd never actually filmed octopus before. You know, I've tended to film things in deeper water, and it was a super, super challenging. A, in terms of the environmental challenges, I think I went through 3 domes. I scratched 3 domes in the process, and I mean, domes are like $2,000 a pop. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was definitely, and just trying to find a language, a grammar, a way of beautifully representing this animal, because you know, I mean, the pressure. You know that, you know, potentially 500 million people are going to see this footage. So,
you know, is that sitting in the back of your head while you're filming?
It absolutely does. Yeah. It's actually one of the things I really enjoy is that pressure when something happens, and, you know, it often takes us. I mean, a recent shoot, we spent 250 hours at sea, 10 hours a day, 20 over 25 days. I filmed for about 15 minutes.
Sure.
You know, so there's that intense pressure when you, I mean, this, the octopus sequence was slightly different, but that was, you know, an incredible challenge to unpack the behavior, to learn, to track the animal, Krager, to learn how to actually find the animal. Often we'd go and we couldn't find the octopus. Mm. So I think that's probably been the most challenging shoot to capture and recreate.
How about you, Steve?
Jeez, every animal is a different challenge, and it takes a lot of learning to be able to try piece together the best way to find what you're looking for.
Mm.
Jeez, Roger, help me out here. We've done so many projects together. It's been, yeah, everyone is a different challenge.
Okay. Lisa, what about you? Is there any one sort of shoot that stands out for you as having been particularly difficult or challenging in some way?
Well, not one that was particularly difficult or challenging, but one that was particularly difficult for me to find, which was I desperately wanted to be in the water, close up filming with a humpback whale. And it's one of those things that we were saying earlier, never mind the fact you have to have permits and there's legalities about filming with them. They are one of the creatures, like most of the marine animals, it is 100% on their terms.
Mm.
You can't chase them down because they can swim faster than you can move. They will just disappear, and you shouldn't chase them down because if they don't want to be with you, you're not going to get that kind of interaction which is appropriate. And I was actually diving for sharks in KZN and filming away and with a group of other British divers. It was just one of these crazy situations. And we heard whale song the whole time but never saw humpback whales. And then a pregnant humpback whale decided that she wanted to come and spend time with us. And she came, and you could see her eyeball looking at us. And all of us were in absolute awe, to the point where actually a couple of us were finning backwards, because she's kind of big and she was coming quite close. And then she turned around and showed us her belly. And it was just, I have to admit, I cried. It's not the first time I've cried underwater, but it was one of those emotional kind of storytelling moments of I'd wanted to be that close to something that special for a long time. And she decided to come and hang out with us for half an hour.
Wow.
Yeah, amazing.
In space, no one hears you scream. Underwater, no one can see if you're crying, so that's fine. What a story, what a story. Somebody asking whether you ever use drones these days to assist in your filming. Stephen, Roger, either of you?
No, drones have become an almost indispensable tool. In the sort of 4 or 5 years ago, it was Cineflex.
Mm-hmm.
So the Cineflex is a gimbal stabilized camera platform that you can put on a helicopter. But obviously, the cost of that is quite excessive.
Yeah.
But I think Planet Earth was the program that kind of put that language on the map. So you had the underwater components, you had the topside components, and then you had the aerial components. And those three together gave it that very magical kind of visual grammar. But the drones certainly have revolutionized things, and they're getting to the point now where, you're getting very comparable kinds of images. I mean, it still can't compete to the same effect as a Cineflex, but they're always there in the field. Mm. They're easier to get up in the air. With a decent operator, and no, they definitely are becoming like a de facto tool in high-end blue chip wildlife production.
I have to say, I saw a guy fishing with a drone dropping his sinker and bait, and I thought it was the height of laziness. I've got to be honest. Sue asking whether any of you have ever had a situation where you felt you were in danger as a result of the animals you were interacting with and shooting. Nobody's nodding. That's a good sign. Like, yeah,
it's been. Really.
I've had to get out the water once because I was in the water with a tiger shark that was just too curious for would have happened, but just too curious for me to be comfortable. And the problem was, if I'd been below the surface, I would have been fine, but I was on the surface. And it's that funny thing that I personally always feel more safe underwater
than floating
on the top.
Yeah, I think people often ask that question, and I think statistically I do not know of one instance where a wildlife cameraman has been killed, No. And there's obviously a Steve Irwin.
Yeah.
And I know the reason why that happened. He approached the animal from behind, it got a fright, and it lashed out. But no wildlife cameraman that I know of has died as a consequence of the animal he or she is trying to film. Generally, where wildlife cameramen die is up in the air. So it's light aircraft, balloons.
Mm. Right.
That's the thing that tends to kill. And then also rebreathers, which... Yeah. Can be very dangerous. But no, also I've got out of the water once, and that was actually funny enough with dolphins.
Really?
They were it was a big group of males, they were mating, very worked up, and I was filming, and then eventually they started peeling off and just charging me, full of testosterone. And out of respect for them, obviously that's a very clear signal. They don't want you there. So it's right.
Got the message, time to leave.
I was under threat, but it was really intimidating to see the, clearly just saying to me, we don't want you here. So it was, okay, I'll get out.
Cheers, and time to leave.
I think it's also a fact of understanding your subject and understanding the behavior of the animals that are going along. And you find professional photographers who have spent a lot of time, have a deep understanding and a passion and a love for these creatures. And when the visibility goes bad, or it's clear that a group of male dolphins or tiger sharks are taking too strong an interest, then you need to back off and move away. So there's certainly been instances where if you put other human beings in the same position as some of the situations we've been in, they would be very, very scared. But all those situations were, I felt connected and I was part of the system. Mm. And like, you can manage these things with body language, by distance, by so many elements that you learn slowly over time by spending so much time out in the water.
That knowledge that has led the three of you to be included in a project of the scope of Blue Planet. It's been amazing to meet you all. My producer's pulling faces at me through the window that I have to wrap up the conversation, I'm afraid. But thank you. Well, first of all, congratulations to all three of you. It really is a professionally such an achievement to be included.